This talk was given at Insight Meditation South Bay. For more information and a schedule of our events, visit the Insight Meditation South Bay website at www.imsb.org. For information about online programs, visit the Bodhi Courses website at www.bodhicourses.org. Bodhi is spelled B-O-D-H-I.
Okay, so the task before us is to see clearly what's going on, to see it very clearly so that we don't get distracted by fixing and blaming and all the other things, but we actually see what's happening. That's what we're going to be talking about today. The second word, uncertainty, pretty well mirrors all the turmoil that I talked about before, the uncertainty of life, the uncertainty of the election, the uncertainty of COVID, the uncertainty of are we ever going to get a vaccine, the uncertainty of when are things going to open up. What is normal going to look like in the future? Is there going to be a normal in the rest of my lifetime? Am I going to be constricted like this? How far in the future am I trying to extrapolate today? All of this has to do with uncertainty. But also it's a word that refers to the idea of impermanence, because uncertainty is a characteristic of impermanence. We don't know. We think we know what the world looks like, what we're like, what's going to happen, and then life happens. It's actually very uncertain. Impermanence is the home of uncertainty. We see that it's in the nature of things to arise and pass away, arise and pass away, arise and pass away. And still, we seem to think we know what should be happening. This is a human thing that we think we know what's happening. So another thing I want to talk about tonight is the wisdom of not certain. Not certain. Not so certain I know what's going to happen. Not so certain I even know what's happening. The wisdom of not clinging to views. Not clinging to views. So the tools that we're going to use are mindfulness, stillness, and investigation through the consideration of the five aggregates. What we're going to explore is our own ability to discern what actually is true. What is this? We can say, it's like this. It's just this. What is this? What is this? In our practice, our meditation practice, we talk about insight meditation, and we talk about it in a way that has to do with mindfulness, but also leading to wisdom. And wisdom is something that arises, is kind of an internal process. It's a discovery process. And that's what we want to look at, is how do we become effective discoverers? What does that mean? Much of our experience is influenced by what we expect to happen. Expectations and tensions. This is the way we set up our conditions. Expectations. But everything happens as a matter of conditions, most of which we have no control over at all. So if rain happens when the conditions are ripe for it. When there's moisture in the air, not that we have so much of that in California right now, but when there is the appropriate moisture and the temperature and the air movement is such, then rain happens. And when those conditions change, rain doesn't go away. It just doesn't happen anymore. Rain is not the only thing this is true about. When the conditions change, everything changes. And the conditions are always changing. And we do not have control over those conditions, but we certainly have influence over those conditions. And we have influence in a lot of different ways. So one of the things we do is we name patterns of experience in certain ways. So something happens and we say, oh yes, this is depression, or this is anger. And something like anger covers a whole lot of bases. We say, well, I'm angry, when maybe I'm not angry, I'm just embarrassed, or maybe I'm just irritated, or maybe I'm a whole string of other words. So one of the things we want to consider tonight is what language is doing, what language we use, how words influence how we see our experience. That the nature of the words that we use can limit or expand our experience in ways that are accurate or more precise or not so precise and not so accurate and not so useful. So those are some of the things we're going to consider. It can be said that suffering arises because things are not the way we want them. Suffering arises when we want things to be other than the way they are. We can call it greed. We can call it hatred. We can call it craving. We can call it clinging. But basically, it's wishing that things were other than the way they are. Well, if that's what gives rise to suffering, wishing things were other than they are, wanting things to be other than they are, it becomes very important to know how things are, how as accurately as possible. What do I mean when I say it's like this? It's like this. What is this? How can I accurately decide what it is? That's the question. And the important part is to be able to say what it is before we judge it, before we call it good or bad, before we say we want it or don't want it, before we say we like it or don't like it. Just what is it? What is the experience? What's the nature of experience? We want to become familiar with just this before becoming, before it's becoming or being judged or being determined to be a set of conditions that we have control over. With mindfulness, we can look at this. This is what's happening and see it very clearly. Mindfulness doesn't take sides. Mindfulness doesn't have judgment in it. Mindfulness is just this. That's an important distinction. So when we talk about mindfulness, we have an object, we have the seeing of the object, and we have the knowing that we see the object. In no way do we qualify the object by that. We don't say it's good or bad. We just see it and know that we see it. So to be clear about that, we all know that we're sitting here. Yep, I'm sitting here. But we don't think about we're sitting. It's kind of a byproduct of where we are. With mindfulness, we say, oh yeah, I'm sitting. I know I'm sitting. There's an awareness that I know that that's true. Okay, there's a knowing that we have. That's an important part of this, that awareness is kind of the focus, the place that we're looking at, but also we know that we're looking there. It's not an accident. Now, when we're threatened, when we feel besieged in some way, we tend to forget all of that and we revert to patterns and we name things in ways that allow us to deal with them according to all our coping strategies. It's just how the mind works. We extrapolate from the experience and say, well, if I were a better person, this would be true. Or if that person didn't do something, then this would be true. We kind of externalize it or we overown it. What we want to do is thread the place, the middle space in between. We just want to know what is the experience all by itself before we try to change it, before the mind changes it. So I could say that I tend to be a fixer. You know, something comes up, I have to fix it. Surely it would look better this way. It would be better suited this way. There must be a more skillful way. My mind habit is I tend to be a fixer. Some people tend to be caretakers. But this is one of mine. I tend to fix and I tend to judge. This is better than that. This can be improved. These are mind habits that I'm aware of. With practice, I have less tendency to do that. I have less tendency to have to fix everything I see and more tendency to just say, oh, this is what's happening. Oh, just this is happening. Now, some of those mind habits like judging and fixing have been replaced with other, perhaps more skillful things, but they exist nevertheless. So what I'm talking about is the ability to see how the mind is responding. That's what we want to look for. How is it working? So it's kind of a process of saying, what else is here? What else is here? So let's talk about the nature of experience. What is experience? This is where the five aggregates come in. In Buddhist thought, we talk about experience being a product of these five things. So the first one is the materiality of something, you know, the physical stuff of it. This is, you know, it's kind of warmish and it's round and it's kind of oblong round and it has different shapes. This is a uniform shape. This shape is kind of irregular and it's rounded at the tip, but flat at this end. These are material things that I can say about this thing. And I can hold this up and I can say, okay, this is warmer and it has these edges around it. It's not smooth. They're sort of flat here and flat here and flat here. And it's a little gritty at the bottom. This is the materiality of this object. Right? So that's one aspect of it. The other one has to do with awareness. I'm aware that I'm holding this. I'm aware of it being here. I can touch it. Has no smell. I can touch this. This has a scent. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's warm. It's kind of warm, still kind of warm, lukewarm. Right? Okay. So these are the physical things. And this is the awareness part. That is, I put my attention there and I know my attention is there. So those are two factors, the materiality and the awareness, the consciousness. I'm conscious of examining this experience. I have an experience of this that is dependent on my noticing it. When it was sitting here on my desktop and I was talking about something else, it didn't exist. It wasn't here. I had no experience of it. It was just there. So there is the object and there's the knowing the object. But then there's something else. So I'm going to look around here. Each of us we're all sitting here listening, maybe, to me talk. And we have some visuals and we have some oral and our minds are going. And all of us are most of us, I think, are sitting. I don't see anybody that's standing. But our experiences are incredibly different. Incredibly different. Maybe some of us are comfortable. Each of us is looking through a different device, hearing by a different way. Each of us is sitting in a different kind of chair. We're comfortable or uncomfortable. We're warm or we're cold. We're neutral. We all have a very different experience of this shared experience. And my experience of this is different than it will be in a minute. because something will have changed. The conditions of these experiences, all of our conditions are different. And even the words that we use to describe them, we have a consensus reality, right? If I tell you that this chair is kind of lavender, I have an experience of lavender. You all have an experience of lavender. I have no idea whether neurologically your experience of lavender is the same as mine. None. It's just over time, I've grown to call this color lavender, and you will call it lavender too, even though our experiences could be very different. This may seem subtle, but it's actually quite important that how we experience is unique not only to the conditions, but to ourselves, based on our experiences, based on how we learned and took in information, how we are focused or unfocused, whether we've eaten or not eaten, whether we had a really exhausting day or not, our experience is going to be very different. And as we talk about this, please be aware of the influence of the language, the words that we choose. If I'm saying that lavender could have a different experience for you, imagine what the words can call up in your mind, what they conjure for you. The words that we use influence the experience. It's huge. The connotation associated to language will affect the experience. So when we name something, when we're experiencing, when we're mindful of it, that name has attached to it all kinds of other experiences. It makes it very complex. So keep in mind language and what the words mean. And when I'm trying to be very careful about what words I choose, but I have habits of speech. And I will say things that you will hear, why did she say that? Whereas we may totally agree on what it is. So just keep that in mind. Okay, so we have the physical aspects, seeing, hearing, tasting, smelling, touching. The five senses, that's the first thing that we have. We have awareness, consciousness, it's the attention and the knowing. But then we get into the other parts of experience. This is where we start making very personal decisions about the experience. So the first one is feeling tone, vedana. Something is pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. This is way before I like or I don't like, I want or I don't want. It's just pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. So this cup to me is very pleasant. I find it pleasing in design. It has little ginkgo leaves on it. I like the green shade. It's a very nice green shade. Also, my experience of this cup is related to the fact that it was a Dana cup. Somebody gave it to me as Dana. So it has a special meaning for me. I have some affection for it as a consequence. There is a feeling that I attribute to this and say, this is pleasant. This cup is pleasant. Even if the tea inside is no longer warm. And the tea is liquid. I like liquid. That's pleasant. Even if I like my tea normally warm, it's still pleasant. It's way beyond neutral. I'm not neutral about it. I like it. It has a scent. The scent is pleasant. It's mint tea. Nice mint tea. Okay, so there's the pleasant, unpleasant part of it. So I have this, and I can ring it, and I can say that's pleasant. Not so pleasant. Pleasant, not so pleasant. Okay, so something is either pleasant or not pleasant, which doesn't have anything to do with liking or not liking. It's before that. Why is this important? Because what we want to do to develop resilience is be able to experience something that is pleasant or unpleasant without needing to react to it. Just knowing it is pleasant or unpleasant. Once we get to wanting or not wanting, we're already on a track to something else, which we call suffering, wanting something to be other than it is. We either want to hold on to it or we want to push it away. That's up to wanting. But just pleasant or unpleasant, we can be with pleasant or unpleasant. We could just be with it. We could just notice it. It leads to, but is not the same as liking or wanting, right? All right, the next thing. So we've got physical aspects, awareness, Vedana, the feeling tone. It's just the feeling tone, not the liking or not liking. The next one is perception. This is the naming function. I call this a cup. I could call it a bowl, but we call it a cup. By consensus, it has a handle. Contains a liquid I drink. I call it a cup. It's a concept, cup. This is a bowl, unless I ring it, and then it's a bell. So we name things. This is where language is extremely important. Whether this is a misshapen bowl or a bell will affect our attitude toward it. So what we name it is important. The concept, but it's just a concept. It's one piece of experience. The experience of this brass thing is that it's both a bowl and a bell. But it has a different sound with my hand than with the striker. Meaning is established by perception. This has a function or a meaning because I name it a cup. The next thing is mental formations. Mental formations is now what I think about it. Now I have opinions about whether I like this or don't like this, whether I have affection toward it or not affection toward it, whether I, you know, it's actually very tippy. It's probably not safe, but you know, I wish I had a whole set of them. Or this is where we start establishing storytelling and the emotional response to our experience. This is an aspect of the experience, the emotional response, the liking or not liking, the wanting or not wanting. That's what comes out of mental formations. When we have any experience, all of these are present to a greater or lesser degree. The physical aspect, the awareness, the feeling tone, the perception or concept, the mental formations, all of them are present in some degree. And all of them influence the experience. All of them are the conditions for the experience. Things like perception and mental formations are connected to views, expectations, intentions. Most of us are in the habit of assigning priority in our experience to the mind. That is perception and mental formations. That's where we place our authority. You know, the brain sort of, we have this idea that the mind is king. The mind tells us what's true. But in truth, what's true is also a function of the materiality, whether we're looking at it, what we're looking at, what kind of attention, what focused attention is there, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. And all of this happens in addition to what's going on in the mind. But we put all of the emphasis on what's going on in the mind. What we think about it, what we call it, how we name it, what the meaning is. For some reason, we think this is an important part of experience, and it is, but it is not all of experience. So, if someone sneaks up behind me and I don't hear them softly, I'm not aware of the threat. Now, suppose they come up behind me and they're actually bringing me tea. I may still react to being startled with a fear or aggressive response, right? Startlement. When in fact, there was no threat. The truth of the experience is all created in my mind. If you surprise me, I'm startled. It's a fear reaction. It's all created in the mind. And the experience is controlled by what the mind decides, what it's named and what it thinks about it. The very word sneak implies threat. When somebody was just walking up softly. No, you were sneaking up. There was no actual threat. So the question is, how often are we aware in our experience of the shift to storytelling? So when we're sitting in meditation and our mind wanders off, we're quite willing to say, okay, I'm lost in storytelling. I'm telling the story. But actually, we do it all the time. We tell a story about what's happening now. What's your story about what's happening now? As opposed to the raw experience, as simple as possible, of what's happening now. The deviation from experience into storytelling involves judgment, justification of meaning, justification of responses, planning, fantasy. All of these are aspects of the mind treating whatever experience you're having. That is the home of views and value judgments. Views and value judgments. This is where we search for meaning. And in that search for meaning, we take ownership of that. These are my values. These are my experiences. These are my understandings. And this is how we create a self. This is who I am. Who I am is a person who has this value, sees this thing, experiences this. We become a person who has this experience. This is neither good nor bad. This is just how it is. What's important is to know this is how it is, so that we can make judgments that are more discerning than value judgments, where we see clearly, this is what's happening. And along with that, this is happening. And along with that, this is happening. So that I don't shut down the exploration of what's happening by naming it something that creates a pattern of response. Simply naming something a problem creates a pattern of response. I could name it a curiosity, but I named it a problem, thereby setting conditions for what happens next, what the response is. So researchers, I read a couple of days ago, maybe yesterday, that some researchers from UC Berkeley, Stanford, and Johns Hopkins did an experiment using functional MRI of people with left and right leaning political adults. And what they were looking for is, with functional MRI, you can look at what areas of the brain light up, where the activity is. And so they wanted to know how these groups varied. And what they discovered, and the way they did the experiment is they showed them videos. And then as the experiment got more detailed, they would extract it down to trigger words. Trigger words. And it turns out that where they noticed the activity was not in the audio and visual context. Those were exactly the same in the two, in both left and right leaning adults. Where they differed was in the prefrontal cortex, in the area of storytelling. Storytelling and meaning. And the trigger words would establish this for this group and this for this group. And they were very consistent within the groups, but not with each other. In the storytelling area, that has to do with threat, morality, and emotions. Threat, morality, and emotions. All of which, you know, it doesn't matter what your political viewpoint is, you have values, you have emotions, you deal with threats. It's just that you can reinforce using trigger words one or the other location in the brain, both in the prefrontal cortex. That's really interesting. It says that language, the words that you use, will affect how you lean, how you establish meaning. So you want to be very careful what words you use and to figure out what your trigger words are. Know what your trigger words are. That's the first thing. Before you worry about somebody else's trigger words, what are your trigger words? Know when you're being triggered. Know what your reactions are when you're being triggered. So, with mental formations, they continue telling the story because we're not paying attention to the fact that we're listening to a story, an internal story, a meaning story. This happens, it means this. It's so quick. It's so quick. We didn't notice that that's what was happening. We didn't see it. We give priority to this part of experience. Meaning has a lot of meaning for us, has a lot of emphasis in our lives. When this happens, I have an emotional response. I'm attracted to that emotional response. It behooves me to know I'm being attracted to an emotional response. It's neither right nor wrong, good nor bad. It simply is. Oh, I've been triggered. This is it. There's a sense of loss here. Oh, sense of loss. Oh, how does that feel? What else is here? Well, oh, disappointment. Oh, oh, I had an expectation. Oh, it's a process of understanding so that I clearly can see clearly what the experience is and don't get lost in the story before I actually know what the experience is. Okay? One of the things it does, we're wired to fend off threats. So that's why it's so quick to run to storytelling. You know, and it's the reason I respond if somebody startles me, because we're wired to react to threats. Okay, that's true. And can I just be startled? Can I be startled without reacting? Yes, I can, actually. But usually I'm not. It depends on how closely I'm paying attention. It gives us a feeling of control over conditions, right? If I know this is good and this is bad, then I can maximize good and do away with bad, which is right there in that business of wanting things to be other than they are. Very close to that business. knowing when I find something pleasant, knowing that it could become liking, can I pause enough in the pleasant to just see the pleasant before I leap to liking it or not liking it? An example of that might be shivers. When you say shivers, shivers usually, well, not always. There are two kinds of shivers. There's the good shivers and the bad shivers, right? But most people will say, well, I'm cold and I'm shivering. This is unpleasant. But it turns out that it's only unpleasant if you associate it with cold is bad. The experience, which you can have if you're still enough and not distracted, of feeling your arm, the hair on your arm rise up, which is the temperature mechanism of the body, feeling it rise up can be quite pleasant. If you just feel that, before you say shivers and shivers are bad, it can be pleasant. You can feel it running up and down your body. A shiver. Oh, it's really cool. And all this time I thought shivers were bad. This is the virtue of being able to see the difference between the feeling tone and what happens after we establish meaning that has good or bad judgments attached to it. So what we're looking for is discerning as close as possible to the experience, just this. It isn't to say that the mind is wrong. The mind is just the mind. And there are habits that create response habits that we want to free ourselves from. Okay, so let's take an example. How am I doing on time? We're going to 8 o'clock. I'm doing terrible on time. Okay, so let me take an example of sadness. Sadness. If I label something sadness, there are many kinds of sadness. There's the sadness that comes from, I'm just weary of fighting the battle. There's the sadness that comes from fear of failure, or fear of missing out, or fear of death, sadness. There is also a form of sadness that I could label tenderness. When I label it tenderness, it has to do with the rawness. And and the feeling of that is different. So a fear response sadness, I'll feel as a concavity and my shoulders were slumped. I have a very physical feeling of that. Sadness that comes from tenderness is quite different. And there's a rawness, and I feel it kind of in the center of my chest. And there's a kind of pulsing there. And as I feel that feeling, that it's almost like a caress. And all of a sudden, what used to be sadness has become compassion. So when I get as precise as possible about something like tenderness, there is space for me to see what it changes to. And I'm not locked into sadness. Oh, sadness. I should do something about sadness. This is going to be terrible. It's going to ruin my whole day. When I stop with sadness, before I get to whether it's fear or tenderness, I don't have the opportunity to let it be. That's where we learn to let it be. Does this make sense? This is where we are. So it leaves room for the detection of how things change. And there can be a kind of softening. And I'm not taking sides. You know, if I label it sadness too soon, I'm taking sides about how I'm going to feel about it. And what I'm looking for is the resilience of not taking sides with my experience. Just this. I have an openness to the experience. And because I have an openness to the experience, I have an opportunity for a different kind of response. There is a space, just a little bit of space, to see oh, this is being triggered. This is happening. When I get very close to the physical aspect, the pleasant or unpleasant aspect, when I put my awareness somewhere and I know where my awareness is, I'm less likely to get carried away by the story. I'm less likely to react from, oh, it's just that again, or that person believes that, and I just can't accept that, and I no longer hear what they're saying. We notice the story of righteousness. This is what drives us. And we tell the story over and over, and it builds, builds, builds. If we come back to what is the experience that I'm rejecting, what else is true in that moment? Well, how can they believe that? And then I notice it has something to do with the value they hold. Oh, it's not my value. Yeah, but it's not bad. It's just a value. Then the way that I meet them can be affected by that. This is real. To know your trigger points helps you not to trigger the reaction, or to know when it has been triggered. It gives you the space to say, is this what I want? Does this match? Is this, so in the midst of an argument, I can say, is this me just needing to be right? How important is that now? It gives me space to decide, is this useful, this response? The Buddha said, whatever is not yours, abandon it. What is it that is not yours? Material form, feeling, perception, formations, consciousness, these are not yours. When you have abandoned them, that will lead to your welfare and happiness for a long time. Abandon them. Know them just as temporary conditions, like the rain. Temporarily, this is what they are. And then they cease to be these conditions. So I want to give you a quote. I apologize, it's taken me way too long to get to this point. But I want to give you a quote from Andrew Olensky, who is the director of the Center for Buddhist Studies in Barre, Massachusetts. And I think he's brilliant. And he wrote a book called Untangling the Self, which I recommend to all of you. And so here's something that he said. Equanimity is not the sort of neutrality that disengages or becomes disinterested, but rather it is an open attitude that is capable of embracing either pleasure or pain without reflexively reacting to them, being able to look upon pleasure without being seduced by it into the craving for more, or being able to look upon pain without pushing it away or craving for it to cease, involves a very different quality of response than what comes instinctively. Equanimity is not the sort of neutrality that disengages or becomes disinterested, but rather it is an open attitude that is capable of embracing either pleasure or pain without reflexively reacting to them. How do we get there? We get there by paying very close attention, by being aware of each of the aggregates that are making up this moment, of understanding that each of these conditions the next set of conditions. So, all experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a corrupted mind, and suffering follows like the wheels of the cart behind the hoofs of the ox. All experience is preceded by mind, led by mind, made by mind. Speak or act with a peaceful mind, and happiness follows like a never departing shadow. May you find the place of stillness in your mind that you discover through mindfulness and see it clearly, so that you can hold in your heart the peacefulness of that place of saying, it's just this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.